Hello everyone and welcome to Boat Briefing. My name is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, Features Director of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Caroline White, our Deputy Editor. Stuart Campbell, who normally joins us, is enjoying a well-earned break this weekend, although I say that sadly, like many Olympians who have been disappointed this week, he too is recovering from a sporting injury from an overstrenuous game of footy. So less lying on the beach and more lying around in hospital, sadly. Hopefully he'll be back on his feet in time to hop on a few boats in Monaco, something I know he's very excited to do. Stick around, and later on in the podcast you can hear Sophia Wilson, our senior editor, catching up with the captain of the amazing La Dacha. For those of you who haven't heard of this yacht before, where have you been? The 77-metre Diamond is owned by billionaire Oleg Tinkov. She's a huge deal and has been to some truly incredible places, so I'm sure her captain has got some really good stories to tell.
Yeah, I actually spoke to Oleg Tinkov a few years ago when he was building the yacht. I think he was up a mountain in Val Thorens, which is the highest ski resort in Europe. And that's the kind of place we usually find him. He's visited both the North and the South Poles, and his idea of a good holiday includes activities like skiing down volcanoes in Kamchatka. He's a serious action man. And he's always got his eye on the next adventure, which is exactly what the Dacha is intended for. It's basically a tool for adventure, like a kind of Swiss Army knife boat. It's really, really cool. And actually, if you want to read more about La Dacha, the boat, it was our cover boat in the March issue. So do go back and take a look at that if you'd like to know more about her. She was delivered in November last year, I think. So it'll be really interesting to hear what amazing destinations she's been to already and what new ones are on her itinerary.
Yeah, she's a proper explorer, isn't she? We get lots of things kind of coming across our desk that claim to be explorer yachts, and quite a few of them you think, yeah, well, I guess they can go to some cool places, but I don't know if you'd really want to. But La Dacha is properly made for amazing adventures.
Exactly.
Well, I've been dealing with a rather more glamorous and less adventure-y side of the super yachting world this week. I've been looking at a big history of super yachts and Hollywood for our December issue. So I promise I haven't just been lazing around at home watching movies, although it's rather tempting with this rubbish British summer we're having at the moment. It's actually, it's a great read, and it's been written by a film critic who's dug out some fascinating facts. It's been really fun, not only remembering some old films that I'd forgotten about that you remember, oh yeah, there is a huge yacht in there, but also just hearing the stories of how some of the different yachts and their owners came to be involved, what went on during filming and what happened after that. But often it seems they've enjoyed this kind of glamorous heyday on screen and then met a rather sad end, which is a bit of a shame.
So can you tell us some of the glamorous stories that we can expect to read in this feature then?
Yeah, many glamorous stories. Well, this one's not so glamorous. This is more of a sticky end. But I thought this was interesting. If you take a look at it's an old film from 1962 called Mutiny on the Bounty, which it has to be said, I haven't seen it and I don't plan to, because it totally bombed at the box office. It made losses of more than $6 million, presumably not because of the boat, because of the acting or the script or something. Anyway, so for the film, the filmmakers commissioned a complete reconstruction of a 1787 Royal Navy sailing ship. So they used drawings from the British Admiralty archives, and it was constructed at the Smith and Rowland Yard in Nova Scotia. It involved 200 workers using traditional methods and took 8 months. So not really a film set, more like a complete, huge, amazing boat. And upon sailing, she sailed via the Panama Canal to Tahiti for the filming. And then incredibly, at the end of the shoot, the producers were just planning to burn it until Marlon Brando, good old Marlon, who was one of the stars of the movie, stepped in to save her from destruction. He decided he wanted to own her. So subsequently, she was used as a tourist attraction in St. Petersburg, Florida, and occasionally appeared on film intermittently. Then she ended up in a strange place in a long forgotten porn movie before being lost forever off the coast of North Carolina in Hurricane Sandy in 2012.
Gosh, that is quite sad. I remember I visited John Wayne's old yacht, Wild Goose, in California a few years ago. And she had this incredible history involving, you know, the Rat Pack would kind of stay on board and shoot skeet off the back of the boat and all these incredible parties that she hosted. But the point I saw her, she was looking rather tired and she was being used as a sort of a party hire venue, really.
Oh, that's tragic, because those party hire boats aren't depressing places. Having been on a few, exactly. They are not the best places to end up.
Yeah, no, exactly. It was a bit depressing. So she did feel a bit sad. And it did make you realise that for an older boat to survive, she really needs a kind of passionate owner who loves her and is willing to spend regularly to maintain her to a kind of time capsule standard. And without that, probably isn't looking good for boats at that age. But a couple of months ago, I saw that she hit some rocks and sank in Washington State, which was very sad. So that is yet another sad end for a glamorous Hollywood yacht.
Yeah. Well, they don't all have such sad ends. I think it's particularly those yachts that were used in the kind of early Hollywood films that were used primarily as sets, really, and then sort of abandoned. But I mean, the most obvious use of yachts in movies, which comes out a lot in the piece, are the Bond films, obviously. And I hadn't quite realised it until the writer pointed out, but it's so true. Bond is nothing without his super yachts and submarines and all the kind of toys that come with it on screen. And there was a great bit of intel from, I loved hearing about how when the James Bond producers rang Spirit Yachts, who obviously make very beautiful boats, to borrow a brand new boat for the filming of Casino Royale. And apparently the boss, Sean McMillan, was really excited and then had a sort of nervous question for them, which is, you're not going to blow it up, are you? Because obviously there's quite a few boats destroyed on screen in the Bonds. And they didn't, obviously, but the filming was pretty extreme. They took the newly built Spirit 54 on a 6-month journey, covering over more than 10,000 miles from Suffolk and Liverpool to Florida and the Caribbean, before an about turn to Europe and back to Venice via Croatia. And it was the first time in 300 years that a yacht had sailed on the Grand Canal, and the mast had to be taken out every time they filmed in order to make it. So they had to take the rig out and put it in again 10 times to keep sailing underneath the bridges. And they had to use a sort of barge with a crane on board to do the job. So less effortless than it looks on screen, that boat.
Absolutely. Well, Charlotte, tell us what news we've got this week from the world of super yachts.
Sure. Well, the first interesting story is that the Dutch shipyard Royal Huisman has launched the very cool, very blue 58.5-metre superyacht Project Fee. It's due to be delivered later this year alongside its 36-metre shadow vessel called Fee Phantom, cool name, which was launched by Alia Yachts in April. The fast displacement aluminium Project Fee was designed by Cordy Rover and is reputedly set to be the longest sub-500 GT yacht in the world. The naval architecture is by Van Oosenen and benefits from the studio's fast displacement hull form, and the interior is by London design studio Lawson Robb. The yacht has a sleek, low hull and superstructure profile with a range of subtle hints to the natural world, according to the yard. Interesting features include a patented swimming pool design, which reduces the amount of fresh water used by heating and treating the water when the pool is not in use. So covered up, it can become a sort of sealed tank at the touch of a button. Fee will also feature an infinite wine cellar, and we look forward to hearing more about exactly what that is. Sounds pretty good to me.
It does indeed. So San Lorenzo has also been busy, to put it very mildly. The Italian yard has launched 3 new superyachts in just 15 days at its La Spezia yard. The 4th and 5th units of the 44.5-metre alloy series hit the water alongside the 6th unit of the 52 steel model. Meanwhile, the yard has also begun construction on the 8th units of both the alloy line and the 52 steel range.
And lastly, a bit of news, something that everyone is talking about all the time, certainly we are a lot, is Monaco Yacht Show, which is obviously planned for September. Many of you, I'm sure, are looking forward to it and reading the news with bated breath after last year's show was cancelled, along with obviously most of the other yachting events. Organisers have revealed that the revamped 2021 Monaco Yacht Show is set to include a yacht design and innovation hub. As a recap, the show as a whole will feature a brand new format, which is focused around superyacht clients for a less crowded and more exclusive show. Aimed at enhancing the show experience of first-time attendees, the new design and innovation section will give visitors the opportunity to meet with superyacht designers and naval architects. Aside from the meet and greet aspect, there will also be live talks from designers who will display their work and talk through the creative process. And the live talks will run as sort of throughout the show, which will take place from September the 22nd to the 25th. This part of the Monaco Yacht Show will be free to all visitors, depending on room capacity and COVID measures, with no registration required. So it should be a good chance to meet a whole new load of designers and see what they're working on. It'll be interesting to see how things go, given it's a bit of a departure from previous years.
Absolutely. I think it sounds like it's going to be a really spectacular event, not least just because everybody is going to be so excited to be there at some sort of yachting event for the first time in, you know, potentially 2 years. Really, yeah, pretty cool.
So that's the latest news. What are you looking at in the data this week, Caroline?
Well, 2021 continues to be a really spectacular year for superyacht brokerage. So we thought we'd take a look at the latest figures to come in, and those are the figures for July. We had 47 sales last month compared to 36 in July last year and 43 in July 2019. In fact, it's the highest number of July sales since 2017, when 53 were sold. But aside from that, there's no July tally to match it in the last decade. And our data guru, Raphael Montagnier, says that with the addition of late announcements that he is expecting, we should reach or even topple that July 2017 record. Looking at July's tally in the context of the rest of this year so far, it's the continuation of a really stellar period for brokerage. Usually in the first half of the year, we can expect to see monthly sales figures around the 25 or 35 mark. But this year we've had 37 in January, 45 in February, 58 in March, 51 in April and 79 in May. Then June's number, which was 86, is the best monthly sales tally in a decade. If we look at the months from January to July this year as a whole, a total of 403 yachts were sold. That's just over double last year's figure for the same period. And if you think that because of COVID, it's not fair to compare this year to last year, that 403 from this year is also 152 more boats than were sold in the same period in 2019. So 2021 continues to be a truly mind-blowing year for brokerage. And yeah, some serious kudos to the guys and ladies who are selling those boats.
God, yeah, I think some serious records are going to be broken. It'll be interesting to see at the end of the year quite how many have been totted up, but some impressive stuff and obviously really good to see.
Yeah, you're completely right, Charlotte. It really is something rather special, and it will be very exciting to take a look at the full year figures at the end of this year.
Fantastic. Well, that's it from Caroline and I this week. Stay tuned to hear Sophia Wilson's interview with the captain of La Dacha.
On today's boat briefing, I'm delighted to be joined by Alistair Reid, captain of 77-metre Darman La Dacha. Delivered last autumn, the groundbreaking yacht is now getting into the swing of her global charter programme, which has seen her welcome guests on board in Russia's Kuril Islands and the Kamchatka Peninsula. Originally from Solcombe, so a little closer to home, Alistair's going to update us on La Dacha's packed first charter season and tell us a bit more about his path to becoming an explorer yacht captain. Alistair, thank you so much for finding the time to speak to us. I think you might be about to win the award for the most remote podcast guest to date. Where are you joining us from?
Good morning, or good evening there. Yes, I'm joining you from Petropavlovsk from Kamchatka, and thank you so much for having me to join you. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you today.
And what's it like there? It's not a kind of yachting destination that we're used to hearing about.
No, absolutely not. It is, as you suggest, very remote. We really do stick out like a sore thumb here. It's something that surprises anyone that sees us out in this region. Not that there are many people to see us out in this region because it is so remote, but certainly the local population is quite gobsmacked and aghast by seeing such a yacht in this region. First time any yacht has ever come here, so it's a great pleasure to be involved in part of this project.
And what have you been up to there? What's kind of taken the yacht there in the first place?
So this is a dream of the owner. He was he had this vision many years ago. He spent many years in the region, in Kamchatka and the surrounding area, heli skiing. It's a big passion of his, this is an area which is truly unexplored in a lot of respects to that, and obviously cruising with the yacht. It's a vision of the owner's 100%, and to deliver the luxury heli skiing on board a yacht And that's purely been made possible by his vision.
And how's it been? Have you been busy? Lots of charter guests? Is it proving to be attractive?
Fully packed season. Haven't had a moment to rest since we've been here. It has been on the go solidly. Very different type of charter guest and client as well, in regards to the fact that it's a lot more like akin to sharing a chalet with your friends. It's that type of holiday experience. So instead of having a family or where there is one principal main charter guest, a lot of our charters have been split amongst a group of people, which brings its own interesting challenges at the same time.
And how's the heli skiing being? Are you a skier yourself?
I love skiing. I haven't had an opportunity to go. I would absolutely love to have that opportunity. But it looks like it's been absolutely fabulous. Of course, we do, as most yachts do nowadays, a trip video for our guests to take with us. And I've been lucky enough to see a few of those with drone footage and camera footage of our guests skiing through powdered slopes and down the side of volcanoes all the way to the sea. It's just fabulous. And just the look of sheer amazement of the guests when they're returning from a day skiing off the helicopter just, you know, says it all. There's no need to work for words when you see the beaming smiles and as guests are coming back aboard. What a fabulous and wonderful experience. And what's caught my attention so much is when I had initially perceived heli skiing, it was something akin to an extreme sport that, you know, only the fearsome and the best skiers in the world could even attempt. As you could imagine them jumping out of a helicopter and skiing vertically down the side of a mountain. But in fact, what I've quickly come to see is it's available for all levels of ability. You know, we've got lovely, serene, blue or green similar style slopes to what you would find in a resort, with that lovely powder filled fields, which is suitable for everyone, but you can also offer the extreme side, so we can cater for all abilities of skiing, and that's something that I never had appreciated prior to this.
And I guess it must depend on the type of guest you have on board, but how does the kind of day-to-day operation run? What are some of the logistics of running a yacht, essentially, as you say, as a floating chalet?
So, I mean, of course, like any yacht, we are catering for the service-based industry here. And a lot of aspects are very similar, as you would imagine, to the same standard that would be delivered on I hope, any yacht around the world. The differences that make it slightly different here in comparison to a more standard yacht is the involvement of an expedition team, and also the types of excursions, expeditions we're doing, and the type of equipment we're using. You know, the logistics of running two helicopters at the same time and being able to stow two helicopters underneath deck. Now, I don't know of another yacht in the world, perhaps you may know better, that has the ability to be flying two helicopters at the same time, to store two helicopters. We've done lots of other activities. I'd never slung underneath a helicopter loads before, like you would see in the mountains, transporting building materials. Well, we're doing that with snowmobiles and transporting barbecue setups ashore underneath helicopters. It's all those very different things that bring a complete logistical nightmare at times. I'm dealing with an expedition team as well as a crew, and trying to take information from both aspects on how we can best run. And the integration there has certainly improved over time. What I had thought would be difficult was for a yacht to integrate with a heli skiing operation. Actually, what I hadn't appreciated is it's also very difficult for the heli ski team to integrate with the yacht and the standards that we expect on board a yacht. So, you know, as always, management of people is key, and normally one of the biggest challenges, I think, for any captain.
And what's the split? How many crew do you have versus your expedition team?
I would say we're around 21 crew on board, and we've had up to 11 expedition staff in there. So it's much more than we had originally envisioned we would carry. Obviously, as you can imagine, 2 helicopters, 2 pilots, 2 technicians. Then there's 3 ski guides, and then we can be carrying ice pilots as well. And then also on top of that, we carry an agent within that. Then, of course, we have fishing guides and excursion guides, hiking guides, and the numbers keep building up and building. And everybody's got their own opinion of what we should be doing here, there. And of course, they're all keen to be involved and push their activity. So it's interesting managing those different, and it's very new to me. Having those different operations on board, this is not something I've come across before, being much more of a traditional, say, sort of yacht captain. Although I've been lucky to cruise some fabulous places in the world, I haven't had that element of such a diverse and an extensive range of additional skills and abilities on board the vessel. And that does certainly bring its own interesting challenges. The biggest thing I found that we really need to pay attention to in this region, and although it's wonderful to have these fabulous itineraries planned months and months in advance, what you can't plan for, of course, is the weather. And the weather is 100% the overriding factor in this region, without doubt. And so every day I'm keenly following the forecast and just planning to the forecast, and that's what we found is the most effective way. You can't stick to the itinerary. We've got lots of options in various different places. If we head south, if we head north, or if we stay in the Petropavlovsk region, there are lots of different options, but the best thing to do is look at the forecast and chase the best of the weather.
And is it very fast changing?
Absolutely. It changes instantly from strong winds. We've had, obviously 70 plus knots of wind with 5 meter seas, which are to get us on board. So trying to find a place to hide out of that and dodging up and down behind islands to around the Kuril Islands, where during the month of June, this past month, it is particularly prominent to expect fog in this region, and it can just come in like a flash and fogged out completely. And then you're just trying to find the clear spots because we can't fly the helicopters. We're almost locked down, and it's just trying to, the battle of, right, what do we do now? Where do we take the guests next? What experience can we give them? How do we find, a clear route to deliver an experience on today? So it's, constant communication with the expedition team, the crew, to work out what is the best option for the guests on that day.
Do you think expectation management has become a big part of that with the guests as well? They may be sent a shiny itinerary beforehand, and then actually when they come on board, explain to them that the weather is going to be boss.
Dealing with expectation management for guests is always challenging. And we hope prior to their arrival to the yacht, and my fabulous team within Imperial are excellent at passing on information. Yes, it is always challenging dealing with guest expectations. We always strive to go above and beyond those expectations, but reality at sometimes does need to take part in some expectations that we're requested.
And challenges aside, I expect your job is the envy of quite a few in the industry. It's such an such an exciting program to be a part of. How did you end up on board? What's the kind of path that's led you here?
So I'd worked previously with the yacht manager, who we'd worked together many years ago on Le Grand Bleu. And he was, second officer and relief chief officer on there. And we'd worked together, and he was in the deck team. And stayed in touch over the years, and you bump into each other. As yachting, as you know, is such a small industry. It's a huge industry, but it's so small. And, reputation is key. And we'd stayed in touch, and one day he, gave me a call, knew that I was looking, unfortunately, due to some changes within the vessels that I had been working, where there'd been a drastic reduction in crew. Due to the need to save HR costs as COVID hit, and that's something that I think affected the whole industry quite drastically. And I was lucky enough that he remembered me and gave me a call, and here I am.
And you started off in the Navy originally. Is that how you ended up in the CPO industry?
Merchant Navy. I started off, as you rightly say, in Sorkham. My first job was cleaning hire boats at the age of 10 years old, and a clear passion for the sea. And at 17, I was halfway through my A-levels, and I just turned around and said, "Mum, no more. I just want to go sailing." And I went off and worked on a sail training ship for a year as the bosun's mate, and took this 74-foot ketch from Southampton down to the Canary Islands, and had a had a wonderful time. But when I got back home, Mum sort of grabbed hold of me and said, "Right, if you're going to do this, you should, you know, do it properly." And I went off and managed, lucky enough, to get a cadetship in the Merchant Navy, where I trained on oil rig supply vessels for 4 years as a cadet. And loved every minute of it. It was great. And at the age of 23, some of my friends, I don't know how to this day, actually, I should ask them, how they got into yachting, had managed to fall into yachting. They said, "Come give it a go. It's great. It's fun." And I managed to get my first job. I took a deckhand's job on a yacht called La Natural D, which is it was a 49-meter turquoise yacht in Monaco in 2003. And I've never looked back.
Your parents must be quite pleased with how it turned out.
I think so, yeah. I hope so. Of course, we all strive to make our parents proud, and fingers crossed we do.
And what advice would you give to anyone, you know, younger now, that's looking to get into the industry, or perhaps is looking to get more down the sort of explorer yacht route rather than the traditional white boat?
I mean, just keep striving for your goals if you know what your goals are. I mean, hard work is key. And one thing that I would suggest that makes anyone's life easier is always try to make the life of others around you easy. You know, always volunteer, always be the one that puts your hand up, and strive to make everyone. And then you'll be the one that's remembered. Yeah, that guy there or that girl there, they were great. They were fantastic and were cheerful. Such a pleasure to have around. They work so hard, and you'll stick out. And eventually, with that, you'll no doubt land that position that you're looking for. I mean, let's be frankly honest. There's no such thing as the perfect job. That doesn't exist. So the pipe dreams of these wonderful, perfect jobs that are absolutely impossible to attain are impossible to attain, because the perfect job doesn't exist. Every job has its different aspects and its different challenges. And although La Dacha is such a fabulous project to be involved in, it's been incredibly hard work and a lot of long, long hours to get us here. But the rewards at the end of visiting these wonderful places.
And do you manage to have any kind of work-life balance when you're on board, particularly when you're somewhere so remote?
I think I've stepped ashore twice in 3 months now, and it's always very difficult to maintain any sort of contact with the sort of outside world. I don't know the last time that I looked at the news or really perceived what's going on in Europe or where you know, what's happening in, with COVID now. I'm very much in my own bubble, concentrated on life out here. I have a young daughter, and of course I keep in contact with her very regularly. But, you know, of course I'm dealing with an almost 12-hour time difference here as well. So as she's going to bed, I'm getting up, and vice versa. So it's always very difficult to maintain, I think, for anyone. And that realisation of work-life balance isn't something that you really perceive or recognize or look for at the age of 17 when you start out on your career at sea. By the time you reach the sort of senior ranks and appreciate the need for more of a balance, it's harder to attain. I'm lucky to have a rotation though, and therefore when I do get home, you know, I can relax and enjoy a bit more of the life rather than work.
And we've spoken a lot about the challenges. What drew you to a programme like La Dacha's rather than being on a kind of more traditional Mediterranean yo-yo?
I hope that the answer to that is clear and obvious. The itinerary. You know, it's an itinerary that brings a lot of excitement, a lot of firsts. As I say, this is the first yacht to ever visit this region. and the first yacht to deliver heli skiing to such an extent as we are. And we'll be heading down towards Antarctica, as you know, for the future. We've visited the Kuril Islands, which was just an absolutely magical experience. And the permissions and administration to make that happen have been extensive. And therefore, I would suggest that, you know, doing something that is challenging and as diverse as this, you know, for me is what it's all about. I like to be busy. I like to be challenged. And this project certainly brings plenty of that with it.
And you mentioned Antarctica's next on the agenda. When are you making the move? How many miles is that going to be?
Oh, so we've got to stop off in Mexico on the way. I haven't got the figures in front of me. You caught me on the hop there. But I think we're around 4,000 miles to Mexico from here. And we're just about reaching our max range to get from Mexico down to, I'm not sure whether we're going to go to Ushuaia or Punta Arenas yet. That's the decision still to be made. But, you know, that's another just shy of 6,000 miles, which is right at the top of our range. So these are all sorts of voyage passage planning that I'm still looking at the moment. Which means we're in the region around 14 days across to Mexico, and we're right up to around the 20-21 days from Mexico down to Punta Arenas or Ushuaia. From there, it's around 900 miles across to King George Island, where we've got our first charter starting at the beginning of December. So busy. There's not going to be much time to stop and breathe as we finish our season here towards the end of September. It's go for a quick warranty pit stop, and then on we go again for another fully packed and fully booked charter season.
And have you spent time in Antarctica before?
No, I have got as far as Punta Arenas before. Never made it across that gap, but I can't wait. I'm super excited about it.
Is there anything in particular that you're looking forward to if you manage to get off the yacht and see some things?
Well, most of it I shall see through walking around on deck and through the bridge windows. I think it's a big bucket list item, isn't it? I think for anyone, just that experience of visiting such a remote region. I'd love to have the opportunity to visit the penguin colonies you know, the whale watching will be fabulous. But having said that, I think I've seen more whales here in the space of a week than I've seen in my whole career prior to coming here. It's the wildlife in this region alone is just outstanding and fabulous, from the bears that we've been lucky enough to see walking up and down the shoreline and walking along the beach, the walruses, the whales, orcas are just, you know, they're like mackerel on the south coast of Devon.
You're probably not aware of them yet, but what do you think are going to be some of the operational challenges down there? Or do you think it's going to be small fry in comparison to where you've been?
No, I think it will be, I've been pleasantly surprised by what is available and the infrastructure that is here. I had envisioned it or planned for it to be worse and was pleasantly surprised that it was better than expected. It is still challenging for sure. Provisioning is going to be difficult. Bunkering is also going to be challenging to certain aspects. Crew changes, all those logistical aspects are certainly going to present their own problems. But we know it's possible. Lots of people have done it before, and we'll work around it. We've engaged EOS as well for the Antarctica season. I'm sure that's a company you're very familiar with, and so they'll be assisting. And this is, you know, really their bread and butter. So I have no fears on that side.
Yeah, I know, having spoken to the guys at EOS, they are looking at a bumper season down there. Why do you think it is so popular and kind of has got, particularly this season, has so much interest?
Well, again, I think that's clearly obvious. Just like, you know, everyone's decided to move out of the cities and into the countryside. COVID has obviously had a huge impact on people's choices and destinations, particularly to high net worth individuals who have clearly got more to lose in their opinion, perhaps, than others. And therefore, being able to also continue holiday, relax, but perhaps try something a little bit more remote rather than the usual Mediterranean runs or something else. And I think people are starting to become more adventurous. There's sometimes a slightly younger clientele of new money, new wealth, and perhaps that brings a little bit more adventure to them, and something they want to see, something different. And I don't blame them, you know. But a lot of people have now done the Monacos, the Saint-Tropez, the various other. Now, what's new? What else has the world got to offer? And we're in a fortunate position to take advantage of that.
And how do you think, without wishing to put you on the spot?
You're going to put me on the spot, yeah.
You know, taking guests and showing them this amazing place, but also the environmental impact that comes with that as more and more guests want to go and see Antarctica or areas like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's certainly something that is I'm very aware of, my crew are very aware of, especially the junior crew. You see it a lot more within the junior crew than the older crew coming through with the educational background of climate change and the impact that we as humans have on our planet. We take it very seriously, as every vessel should do. We are stringent in our planning and also the machinery that we carry on board to help us deal with the environmental impact. Our storage facilities are, we've got cold store for up to 40 days autonomy. And we also obviously comply with all regulations for Antarctica and polar regions. We're an eco-compliant vessel. And with that comes the machinery and equipment to ensure that we comply.
And it's obviously quite a short season in Antarctica. So do you know where the yacht's planning on heading to after that?
Yeah, the plan and the intention is straight back up to Kamchatka again. So it's and we've already got repeat clients who have come back and said, right, I'm coming again next year. Bookings are quickly going, and I don't think we've got a huge amount of space left in next year's calendar already. I think we are going to be another bumper full packed season next year up here in Kamchatka. And I hope that we get a little bit further up to Chukotka as well. But the port of Anadyr hasn't managed to open up because it was all iced up until the 1st of July. So it's literally just opening now. But for any interested parties out there listening, I would say get in quickly and contact the broker and make a booking. Because I think you'll find there won't be any spaces left soon.
And with such packed kind of charter seasons, but you know, both seasons, how do you keep the crew fresh and kind of going? Because it does put a lot of pressure on the crew if they're doing back to back.
Motivation is a key part of the captain's role, and man management, as we've already discussed, is critical. All the crew as well have the senior positions have a rotation. And in the junior positions, we also run a reduced rotation, but we do run a rotation. The idea is that nobody will spend longer than 3 months on board the vessel. Now the weather is improving here, that makes life considerably easier. But at the beginning of the season in April, when we were appreciating this harsh weather, we had icing on the vessel, the deck crew outside in freezing conditions, having to manage just launching a tender or recovering a piece of equipment was exhausting in itself. Now I've got beautiful blue skies outside, absolutely stunning weather, and that just makes such a difference to the team. I think we all appreciate that when it's wet, raining, and windy outside, and you look out the window, puts a slightly grim outlook on things, but you know, you walk out onto blue skies and sunshine, and that just automatically puts a smile on your face. So weather is a huge factor in that. Crew motivation is a huge factor, but also ensuring that, from my aspect, and I know from a crew's aspect, it's very important that there is some structure to a crew's rotation, to their leave. It's very important for everyone to be able to plan. And now we've finally managed to get in place a structure where everybody can plan. They know when they're coming, they know when they're going, within reasonable flexibility, of course. It does make life a lot easier for them as well. They can plan what they're going to do on their time off. And I think just ensuring that crew are rested and have a break is absolutely important.
And what do you think, it's great that you're getting repeat clients, but what do you think is drawing people to La Datra in the first place?
It's a new experience, I think. And, you know, people are looking for those new experiences. Heli skiing is something that at the beginning of the season has been hugely popular. And people have just come for the heli skiing. That's it. We've taken people, our guests, to these fabulous remote locations where no one has skied in this area before. It's completely brand new. Not one person. They are the first people to ever ski on this volcano, on this slope, in the middle of an island chain, or up to the north in a fjord. First people to, and you know, sitting there with absolutely no one around them, doing a barbecue on the beach or on the deck, and you know, it's a first. It's just, and what wouldn't draw people to something like that. Now we're moving into much more of a fishing season. I've been surprised how many keen fishermen we've got. So we've been doing salmon fishing in the river, halibut fishing in the sea, and the cod that we've been catching is just unbelievable. Just, they're almost jumping into the boat. I've never appreciated such good fishing in all my years at sea. And being a keen fisherman myself from Devon, doing a lot of bass fishing at home, I really do appreciate the quality of the fishing here.
And out of interest, from your heli skiing clients, have you had clients that had never been on a yacht before or a super yacht before? They just came for the heli skiing, or had they had super yacht experience before?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had first time yacht charter clients this year. This is the first time they've ever. We've had obviously clients that have chartered the yachts and have a huge extensive experience in chartering yachts and know what the standards are and what to expect. But very definitely we've had first time charter guests on board the boat. And I'm really happy to say that the feedback that I've received, both from the guests and also later on from the management company, has been fantastic. I'm very proud of the efforts of my crew, particularly with the charter clients that have repeatedly chartered yachts in the past, as they should already have an understanding and idea of where we are. And I think I'm very happy to hear that we seem to be doing a good job at the moment.
And it sounds like a pretty amazing first season. Do you have one kind of standout memory or highlight that you think you'll take with you?
Not one. I've been asked this question a few times now, and there isn't one. Again, I talk about firsts a lot, but I have so many firsts that I've appreciated on this trip. First time that I've travelled through ice fields. First time I've seen a bear in the wild. The amount of whales I've seen. Being lucky enough to be alongside a whale carcass. I hadn't realised, but we travelled into the centre of a volcano within the island chain. It's called Broughton Bay. Now, just prior to going, or just after going in there, nobody had advised me that no one had travelled into this centre of this volcano through this uncharted channel for over 15 years. And the last person that had tried, we saw evidence of what had happened to them on the rocks just beside that. Now, I think quite happily that they hadn't told me that until afterwards, but I will always take these sorts of memories with me, that we've just done such an amazing trip here. And it's difficult to remember 3 months ago. It feels like 2 years ago, in the fact that we've crammed so much into the last 3 months. And I will always take that with me. It's been a fabulous experience.
It sounds absolutely incredible, and it's no surprise that it's proving to be such a popular program. Thank you so much for your time today. I know you've got a million things to be getting on with all your crew and expedition team. So thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for reaching out to us and letting us share our story.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.